This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
If you're going to say to me, you know, can I guarantee that 100% of all illegal immigrants will be removed? The answer is no. What I can say is that we will move enough and quickly enough that it will provide a massive deterrent to future illegal immigration.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Hello and welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. In the week, we reported the possible return of international train services to Ashford. We heard from Rochester traders about the introduction of ANPR cameras, and St George's Union flags started to appear on lampposts and many roundabouts across the county. I'm Simon Finley, the local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by Dan Essen, who reports on the borough and district councils.
Hello.
And Robert Boddy, who looks after Medway Council.
Hello.
And senior news editor Nikki White, who'll be looking after what's happening with our MPs.
Hello.
Our special guest today is former Maidstone Tory MP Anne Widdecombe, who is now a member of Reform UK, and not to forget, a former contestant on Strictly Come Dancing. Dan, what's been happening up your way?
So I've had the pleasure of revisiting the issue of international train services, or rather lack thereof, at Ashford International, and the possible impact of bringing them back.
Any particular reason to cover this again, or was it just a slow news week?
No, there is actual news. So this week, a report was released by the Good Growth Foundation, a relatively new think tank, into the economics of Ashford International, the loss of international services, and what could come out of bringing them back. Their report, which was signed by numerous local Labour MPs, argues that restoring international railway services to Ashford could generate over 500 million quid a year every year for the British economy, and that the sudden end of services in 2020 has meant that about £80 million worth of infrastructure for those services has pretty much gone to waste since. Among local politicians in Ashford, there's been strong cross-party support for bringing the services back pretty much ever since they were shut. So I'm sure this research will feature heavily in their arguments for it.
Is there any chance of those services coming back, do you think?
Not in the immediate term, but maybe. So currently Eurostar has a monopoly on railway services to Europe from Britain. They were the ones running them at Ashford International. And ever since they ceased doing them during the COVID pandemic, they've pretty much always repeated the same argument that it's not really their priority and that they'll reevaluate it in 2026. However, a couple of other companies, Gemini and Virgin Railways, have expressed an interest in taking on the route and running services which go via Ashford. So probably not in the near future, but maybe in the medium term, that there is an interest in bringing them back.
Robert, what's been going on in Medway?
Well, Medway Council have unveiled plans to expand vehicle restrictions on Rochester High Street and use automatic number plate recognition cameras, ANPR cameras, to enforce existing and new rules. Currently, restrictions apply, so between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. on Saturdays, only cars with permission can enter Rochester High Street. But Medway are consulting on the possibility of expanding these rules to Sundays and bank holidays as well.
And are they going to use the ANPR cameras to enforce this?
Yes. Previously, chains were put across the roads which enter onto the high street to prevent cars from entering, and those with permission would have to get out of their car, remove the chains, drive through, put them back. But in February last year, it was decided to remove the chains and use ANPR cameras instead. The cameras will also be used to enforce other rules of that road, including no left and right hand turns from Bowley Hill. The council says this will be more effective in preventing those who shouldn't use the road and more convenient for those who should.
And what do the local businesses think about this?
It's a real mix. Businesses tended to appreciate the effective pedestrianisation, but some thought the use of ANPR was overzealous and fined people who didn't actually deserve it. Others said they felt a physical barrier would be more effective. Locals were almost entirely in support, saying cars travelling down the high street, even when they are permitted, can do so unsafely. So anything to reduce the number of cars is approved. Most also thought the use of ANPR was a good move and would quickly see results. But one or two expressed the view that it was likely a money spinner for the council. Councillor Alex Patterson, however, has said, and probably will continue to make the point, as he does with all traffic restrictions, is if you don't break the rules, you don't have to pay the fine.
Okay, thanks, Rob.
So, Simon, what's been happening at County Hall?
Rather like the Reform UK HQ over the summer, recessed the leadership. Kent County Council has been doing its best to keep themselves in the news. The latest attention grabber for KCC leader, Lyndon Kemp-Caron, was to ask the council leaders in Kent to unify over a High Court victory by Epping Forest Council to not to have asylum-seeking hotels. It's effectively an interim ruling which the government is hoping to appeal. But the leaders were asked if hotels in each of these districts had asylum hotels in use or were using or planning to use houses of multiple occupancy. She did so because she said we must also always prioritise the safety and well-being of our Indigenous residents.
And what sort of response did she get from those other council leaders when she asked?
Well, I managed to track down three to get some sort of reaction, and none of them said that they would be engaging with Councillor Kemp-Caron. The Green Party leader at Maidstone Borough Council, Stuart Jeffrey, alleged the letter was based on division, while the leaders of Dartford and Sevenoaks councils said they would not respond because there was no issues of that nature on the batch. Conservative Dartford leader Jeremy Kite, who's been on this programme, did however make the point that if a hotel had planning permission to be a local amenity for use by local people and ended up being used as an asylum hotel, then he suggested he might be taking the same trip as Epping Forest. So by implication, did Councillor Kite agree with the course of action by Epping, yet wanted nothing to do with Reform's call for unity on that very topic? And it sounds a very clever way of gently snubbing Reform's high-profile KCC leader. Equally, is Reform UK asking the question and getting by getting no response, actually loading the gun with ammo to fire back at her political opponents at a later date? All of this comes at the time when Nigel Farage has announced a package of measures to tackle illegal immigration, including mass deportation of migrants who come here by illegal means, such as the small boats in the Channel. Right, Nikki, what's been keeping you busy this week?
Unsurprisingly, it's flags. Nobody can have failed to have noticed the growing number of Union Jacks and St George Crosses appearing up lampposts and adorning bridges across our major roads. Now, people's reasons for putting them up vary widely from one end of the spectrum to the other. And when that happens, there's usually some kind of political debate about it too.
So what's it all about?
So the wave of flags and road markings is part of a national trend dubbed Operation Raise the Colours. It first gathered momentum during the Lionesses Euros run earlier this summer, and it encourages people to show pride by flying England's St George's Cross and the Union Jack from bridges, lampposts and street furniture. There's been a significant rise in such displays in towns and cities across England in recent weeks. Now, supporters say they are doing it as a celebration of heritage and community, but some argue that it feels pretty provocative at a time when national tensions are running high over immigration and identity. And some people have even painted the word "stop the boats" across flags, making their feelings very clear.
It's really caused some debate, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. Labour MP Mike Tapp, who represents Dover and Deal, has been pretty vocal, saying our flag stands for our beloved British values, tolerance, strength and decency, and is not a symbol of division and weakness. But a war of words has erupted between one Kent MP and a Kent County councillor after St George Crosses appeared on roads and roundabouts in their part of the county. Now, Labour's Tony Vaughan, he's the MP for Folkestone and Hythe, he took to social media to raise concerns over what he described as graffiti in Dymchurch and called for action from Reform's councillor David Wimble. In his post, Mr Vaughan said he was all for seeing the St George flag, but the road in Dymchurch looked awful and was a waste of taxpayers' money as the council would then have to clean it off. He called on Councillor Wimble in his role as KCC's Environment Cabinet member to call it out.
So what did Mr Wimble have to say about it?
Well, his first response was to point out that the only contact he says he ever has with Mr Vaughan is through his social media posts. He says he's tried emailing Mr Vaughan 12 times requesting meetings with him over various matters. On this, though, Councillor Wimble went as far as to say that these acts of vandalism could be a blunt message to the Labour MP and that the people of Folkestone, Hythe and Romney Marsh, and in his words, they aren't exactly thrilled with this policy of turning a blind eye while unchecked migration overwhelms communities. Councillor Wimble went on to warn the MP that this was just the beginning and he should brace himself for many weeks to come as people show their dissatisfaction in one way or another. However, anyone thinking of doing that just needs to know that under the Highways Act of 1980, attaching items to highway structures or painting road markings without permission is legal, and authorities can order their removal or seek costs from those responsible, so that protest might cost you more than you think.
Okay, Nikki, thank you very much.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
For 40 years, our special guest has rarely been out of the public eye, and according to the blurb for her autobiography, she's fearless, frank and engaging. Anne Widdecombe spent 23 years as a Conservative MP in Kent, serving as a government minister for part of it, standing down in 2010. She chose a very different path thereafter, in television not least, an unforgettable stint on Strictly Come Dancing. 9 years after quitting frontline politics, Anne emerged as a Brexit Party MEP, briefly, and is currently the immigration and justice spokeswoman for Reform UK. Anne Widdecombe, welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
Before we start, could you just give us a sort of overview of how you got involved in politics and what made you want to become an MP?
Yes, I was growing up in a very, very different age. I was a post-war baby. And so when I was coming to political consciousness, we were very much in the grip of the Cold War, which effectively meant that the globe was divided into two conflicting political ideologies, capitalism and communism. And such was the intensity of that contest that everybody knew which side they were on. They knew it with their head, with their heart, with their very gut. Nobody would ever have said to you in those days what they're always saying to me now, which is, oh, you know, you can't tell the difference. You're all the same. So it was quite an intense period politically, and young people tended to get engaged in those days, very engaged in politics. And I was on the capitalist side of that great argument. And that was what I think first inspired me to go in.
Now, you became an MP and you spent your time serving Maidstone and then later Maidstone and the Weald. Tell us about your time there. Did you enjoy your time as an MP for Kent?
Oh, yes, I did. I mean, I'm very glad I chose to spend my life that way. I wouldn't have done anything else. And I did enjoy it. I enjoyed the individual casework. I enjoyed the broader constituency work, for example, the Channel Tunnel rail link. It was always a very great pleasure to solve things on people's behalves. I mean, I think probably one of the moments that really stands out for me as an MP is not in any front bench capacity, although I was on the front bench at the time, but acting purely as a constituency MP. I managed to get one of my constituents out of jail in Morocco. And the reaction of his wife when I phoned her up and said, John's out, he's with the ambassador, he'll be home in 48 hours, told me why it was that I'd become an MP.
I didn't know that, actually. So what had this chap in Morocco done then?
Well, the allegation was that he had been trying to export drugs. The reality was very different. He hadn't taken the lorry out there. He hadn't been with the lorry. When he went out to collect the lorry on behalf of his company, he was in public the whole time. He had no chance whatever to construct
a compartment
and then fill it up with hashish. You know, it was a nonsense. Yeah. And I think even the Moroccans knew it was a nonsense.
OK, we're speaking 4 years out from a general election. Most of the polls seem to suggest that it will be won by your party, Reform UK, and you're one of the few people inside that party apparatus who has experience of government. Do you think Reform is ready for government?
Yes, I do. And of course, the numbers of us that have that experience are increasing. I mean, when I first joined Reform, I was the only one. But since then, we've had people like Jake Berry, Andrea Jenkins. You know, we've got people now who have experience of Parliament, who have experience of ministerial work. Not enough, but, you know, there are still 4 years to go. And I also draw an analogy with Tony Blair. I mean, when he won in 1997, after 18 continuous years in opposition, there were very, very few people on his benches who had any ministerial experience at all.
But a lot of them had been MPs, though, Anne.
Yes, they'd been MPs, but they hadn't had responsibility of actually running a government. Mm-hmm. And we've got MPs. You know, we've got people with that sort of experience.
Do you think Nigel Farage is fit to be Prime Minister?
Yes, I do, because I think he's exactly what we need at this time. Mm-hmm. He is not like the leaders of the other parties. He doesn't hedge about. He's got a very straightforward agenda and he's got the courage of his convictions. I mean, Nigel Farage, from outside Parliament, from no position of power at all, managed to get us out of the EU. And that is a major achievement. So imagine what he can do when he does have power.
like we said, Anne, you were a Tory for many, many decades.
55 years.
And obviously, now you're a member of a completely different sort of still right-wing, but essentially insurgent party whose goal is to essentially displace or destroy the Tory party. What changed? Why did you leave the Tories and why did you end up joining Reform?
I didn't leave to join Reform. Initially, I left to join the Brexit party. And that was in 2019. Now, in 2016, Britain had voted to leave the EU. By 2019, not only had we still not left, but there was the most incredible muddle going on in government. And I just felt that I'd had enough and that I wanted a proper Brexit, and that I wasn't going to get that with Theresa May. So I decided, therefore, and I'm quite convinced that it was the right thing to do, I joined the Brexit party and agreed to stand for the European Parliament. Now, quite honestly, if you'd said to me, at the turn of the year in 2019, that I was going to join the Brexit party, and not only that, but I was going to become an MEP, I would have just laughed. But by April, I had reached that point.
That's really interesting. Just bringing forward to this week, on Tuesday, Nigel Farage launched Operation Restoring Justice, a programme of mass deportations that's designed to save 10 million quid and obviously sort out the illegal immigration problem. Realistically, can this work?
Yes, it can. If you're going to say to me, can I guarantee that 100% of all illegal immigrants will be removed? The answer is no. What I can say is that we will move enough and quickly enough that it will provide a massive deterrent to future illegal immigration. I've been saying since 1999, used to say in Kent a tremendous amount, that I believed that the answer was to house all new asylum seekers in secure reception centres. I've been saying it since then. I said I made it the party, the Conservative Party policy in the 01 election. And now, and at last, we've got a potential Prime Minister who's prepared to do it.
Yeah. How involved were you in the actual policy making for Operation Restoring Justice?
I wasn't particularly involved in this one. I'd already been involved in, because we'd already said we would set up secure camps, so that was already party policy and in turning the boats around. But in this most recent one, not very much. And that is a good thing because, the less that the party has to depend on, passe old people like me, and the more it can go ahead with new policies, the better.
Barely a year after Labour's massive landslide victory, they're in the depths of despair poll-wise, and the Tories are in danger of disappearing off the face of the earth. I mean, what on earth has actually happened to British politics, Anne?
It's going through one of those periods which it goes through probably about every 100 years or so. The last major upheaval was when the Labour Party came from virtually nowhere. It came from the trade unions, just as Reform has come from Brexit. But it wasn't previously a party, and it moved with very, very great rapidity and finally got into government. And I think we're in that stage now where people are fed up with both the main parties. They don't see either of them as having the solutions to the things that are worrying people, and they want to give it a chance. And I think one of the interesting things about the most recent Lord Ashcroft set of polls was that even those who weren't yet ready to commit to vote Reform were saying that they were nevertheless glad it was around. So, there is a feeling that something new and determined is needed.
Historically, you've been no stranger to quite controversial positions. Yeah, you previously argued against equalising the age of consent for same-sex activity and against gay marriage. Do you think a future Reform government should enact laws like that, repeal gay marriage and reintroduce a differential and someone say discriminatory age of consent law?
First of all, I think those things should be conscience votes, free votes. Secondly, if you tried to now repeal the gay marriage law, you would have legislative chaos, because you would have one set of people with one set of rights and another without those rights at all. It would just be chaotic. So I don't think Reform will be, putting that at the top of its agenda. I think Reform is going to concentrate on the things we desperately need to do, such as immigration, lower taxes, getting some rigour into education, getting the NHS sorted out. These are big, big things which are going to take up most of Reform's time, certainly in the early years.
On sort of similar issues of conscience, obviously you've long been an opponent of abortion and all liberalisation of abortion law on religious and ethical grounds. Similarly, do you think, if that's your position, do you think reform should commit wholesale to recriminalising abortion?
No, I mean, I believe, and I know that Nigel Farage also believes, because I've talked to him, I believe very firmly that this is a matter for a conscience vote and a free vote, not for a party whip.
Interesting. Something else I wanted to ask. So reform, like say, all the polls are saying reform could win the next general election. Reform clearly speaks to a very large strain of public opinion and is clearly not in and of itself an extremist party. But do you think increasingly there might be a bit of a danger of reform ending up with very extreme bedfellows? You know, for example, I was at a demonstration in Dover a few weeks ago where there were local reform councillors and members alongside people from the remnants of UKIP, which I'm sure you know is a very different party now to what it used to be, and even members of the avowedly white supremacist party like Patriotic Alternative. At a demo in Maidstone the other week, Kent reform councillors were standing alongside a man who was wearing the flag of the British National Socialist Movement. Do you think reform needs to guard against the influence of genuine extremists?
Well, we're doing that. I mean, we're doing that already. We have one of the most stringent vetting procedures when it comes to finding council candidates, for example, and certainly for parliamentary candidates. One of the most stringent vetting procedures that any party has ever devised. But nobody is ever, first of all, 100% safe on that account. You know, Labour has some very odd people in it who are coming, of course, from the far left rather than the right. And we just have to be on our guard. But frankly, who stands next to us is not within our determination. If I'm out on a demo, which I never am, but supposing I were to be out on a demo in favour of pro-life, for example, and somebody came and stood next to me, I don't have control over that.
But surely it says at least something that, you know, that reform is even in the position of having to devise a very strict vetting procedure, because, you know, it's the nature of it that not that many people are involved in politics, and the people who are involved in comparatively non-mainstream politics, there's often a risk that you end up with slightly unsavoury characters.
Well, as I've just said, you know, that's exactly why we've got the vetting procedure. It's exactly why we've got the vetting procedure, is to try and make sure that doesn't happen. And as time goes on and we form a mainstream government, the necessity for that will diminish as people realise what we're really about.
The Labour government wants to streamline local government with a series of pretty major reforms right across the country, and that started already. Speaking with your hat as a former Runnymead district councillor, can you see the need for reorganisation?
That was a long time ago. I instinctively react against reorganisations, because normally what happens when you have them is that they take a long time to sort out. They end up very bureaucratic. And not always, but usually at the end of the whole procedure, there isn't that much improvement. So I would rather focus on what local authorities are doing, as we're doing through our what's called the DOGE initiative, examination of expenditure and efficiency.
Yeah.
I'd rather look at what they're doing than go in for another wholesale reorganisation.
You stood down from the House of Commons, well, must be 15 years ago, and you've been on quite a journey, you know, embracing many new things that people probably wouldn't have expected you to do, such as Strictly and starring in Panto and so on. Was that a conscious decision on your part after politics?
No, it just sort of happened. I did intend to retire, and I underlined that three times, retire. That's what I intended to do. And I agreed to do Strictly Come Dancing, which I had turned down every year on the trot before that, because I was still an MP and I didn't think it right to do it then. But as soon as I was no longer an MP, I said, yes, OK, I'll do it. I honestly expected to be out within the first couple of weeks. I really did. Wasn't expecting to be there in week 10, which I was. And that just led on to things which I couldn't possibly have ever planned. Mm-hmm. It led on to doing the live tour, to doing pantomimes, as you rightly said. Also to being on even at the Royal Opera House in a Donizetti opera. It just led on to things that I was not expecting. And I think it might have gone on doing that until, as I say, in 2019, I just became too frustrated with the then political situation.
Do you like to challenge people's perceptions of you?
Not really. And to a certain extent, you can't.
Yeah.
You know, if people have made up their mind about you, probably nothing you can say or do is going to change it. So, yeah. You know, I just carry on.
Here you are, 77 years old. I'm sure you don't mind me mentioning your age.
Not at all.
When most folks would be tending their West Country gardens, what keeps you going? What's the driver behind you?
Well, I think what kept me going through Brexit and through reform has been, I suppose, the way I put it at the time that I joined the Brexit Party was duty wasn't just calling, duty was positively howling. And I just feel I want to help get reform on its feet. And it's obviously doing that without much help from me. And I want to help in that effort. But then I really do intend to retire, again underlined three times, maybe with as little hope as before.
OK. Anne Whittingham, many thanks for taking the time to speak to us today.
Thank you.
In the past couple of weeks, you can't help but notice that counties' lampposts and road markings are being adorned by the flags of St George or the Union flag. It has also provoked quite a lot of debate in our office about what exactly this all symbolises and what it means. Dan, is it a sort of anti-establishment protest, do you think?
I think it is in a certain way. Obviously, there's been some sort of excitable reports by the likes of like Hope Not Hate, who say that this thing is, you know, organised by sort of shadowy forces on the extreme right behind the scenes. Whether that represents everyone who's doing this kind of thing, it's hard to say definitively just because of how diffuse those organisations tend to be. But I think it is quite novel and interesting that in a developed, advanced modern democracy, the national flags have come to, in the eyes of many people, to represent a genuine anti-establishment politics. That's the kind of thing that you historically only see in, you know, for example, somewhere like Northern Ireland, or large countries which collapse into, you know, smaller ones, their constituent countries like Yugoslavia. Part of that, I think, is because sort of over the past 20 years in particular, the official branding of the British government has been a sort of very corporate, global Britain, not explicitly patriotic type thing, which means that many people feel that there was formerly some kind of shame attached to flying the national flag, which now they don't. And it's just interesting that it's even considered unusual to see the national flag around in Britain. So I was in Estonia a couple of months ago, and in like regular residential neighbourhoods on the outskirts of provincial cities, completely normal, every single house, every single block of apartments have a huge flagpole on it with the Estonian national flag on it. Whereas now in Britain, if you go somewhere and you see the preponderance of the Union Jack or the St George's Cross, it's considered quite unusual. So I think it is quite novel, and it's not unsurprising that it's become an artefact of sort of right-wing politics.
Mm. Nicky, do we fly the flag enough, or is the permission to be patriotic sort of being abused, do you think?
I don't think that we celebrate our flags enough in this country. Mm. Dan's right. You might drive past the odd flagpole here and there in people's gardens. But generally, I feel we're not only a little shy, but almost embarrassed to display either St George Cross or the Union Jack to demonstrate we're proud to be British. I mean, the only time we ever really seem to show our pride in this way is either during some sporting occasion or maybe to commemorate something like VE Day or a royal wedding or the coronation. But other than that, you barely see it. I'd love to see people flying our flags more to visibly show our pride in our country, and maybe this will prove to be the catalyst for that. Maybe if we all try and focus on a flag as the flag flying as a positive message, this could be a really great thing. But right now, I think there's many people like me who would now think twice about flying a flag, and you're worried that the message that you're trying to get across would be misinterpreted. I mean, don't get me wrong, people are entitled to protest, but I don't want to be driving home as I have been and see a flag, my country's flag, dangled from a bridge with "Stop the Boats" daubed across it. Paint your message, if you must, on a sheet or a bit of cardboard, but don't bring our nation's flag into it.
Okay, Rob, what do you make of this thing?
I have to disagree slightly, I think, with some of the things that have been said in terms of that. I think the objective of the people who are hanging these flags is to create an element of the flag being anti-establishment. The message that they basically, and I think people are aware of this, is that basically if you say, well, you shouldn't paint the St George's Cross on a roundabout, or you shouldn't hang random flags from lampposts and block road signs, they'll get the response of saying, oh, you don't want us to show our flag, do you? You hate this country. That's the reaction they're trying to create in this. I don't think it's anti-establishment, but I think it's...
So you think it's a provocative act?
I do, to a certain extent, but it's not provocative. It's the flag of the country. What is provocative about that? They're trying to create this sort of discussion, and the benefit they want to see is that they will say, well, you're not allowed to fly the flag. You know, we're just flying the flag. We should be allowed to do that, but they're not letting us do it. And by trying to create this element of suggesting that the St George's Cross or the Union Jack is an anti-establishment thing, every time the Union Jack or the St George's Cross is then used, then it's a display of anti-establishment. Well, what if it's just people flying the flag because it's, you know, England football is on or the rugby is on or whatever? I think a lot of this is confected, and I think people who want to benefit from this want us to read too far into this and say, oh, we've got this national shame about patriotism and stuff, and we've got to reclaim that for our country. I don't think we do. I think we're not, you know, if you compare us to like America, where they have, you know, fireworks and the 4th of July and all this sort of thing, and they go crazy. I mean, Donald Trump has talked about locking up anyone who burns the flag, which is protected by the First Amendment. That's, if you suggest that here, that would be really strange. We're just not that kind of nation. And to pretend that we are only benefits, I think, one specific group of people who want to create division.
Yeah, and the journalists are obviously interested.
Yes, and us
in
as well.
August. That's your lot for this week. Thanks to Dan, Robert and Nikki for their contributions, and to our special guest Anne Widdicombe. Don't forget to keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics coverage, and you can also sign up for our politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters, and don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, im-listening.co.uk.